Good evening, I greet you in the precious name of our Lord and of our Savior Jesus Christ. We've been running Biblical Worldview Seminars since 1990, and we've been doing it in many countries in four continents, as far afield as Poland and Romania and Albania, Sudan and the Congo and Nigeria, Zimbabwe and Zambia, in the United States and throughout South Africa and Namibia. The Biblical Worldview Seminars aim to apply the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. And what we need to consider as we look at minds, morals, and movies is Hollywood seems to be on a crusade against Christianity. And the scripture tells us, be very careful then how you live. Not as unwise, but as wise. Making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. Hollywood didn't always start out being quite negative. In fact, you'll see a film later on, Hollywood Be Thy Name, how Hollywood actually started out very Christian. In fact, they were offering free land to any church that wanted to establish themselves at Hollywood. In the early days, Hollywood produced some very fine Christian movies, in fact. But we're talking about ancient history right now. At the moment, Hollywood has become the epicenter for an enormous amount of anti-Christian bias, and looks nice from far, but it's far from nice. I've been there a few times and met quite a lot of the folks involved, and my goodness, the hostility against basic principles of Christianity is huge. It really is some kind of Sodom by the seaside. But we're all affected by it. We need to know, we need to understand what Hollywood teaches, what they stand for, so that we get the view from the Sunset Boulevard and we're able to counter it, because otherwise we're going to be brainwashed. There's a lot of Christians today who might be Christians in their heart, but they're humanists in their minds. And the reason is they're following the stars up on Hollywood Boulevard. Marilyn Monroe mused, Hollywood is a place where they'll pay you $10,000 for a kiss and 50 cents for your soul. Jesus said, what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but if he loses his own soul? Universal Studios produced the most blasphemous antichrist film in the history of the world, The Last Temptation of Christ. Many Christians boycott them for years as a result. There is tremendous power in art and entertainment to change lives and shape society, for good or evil. Through the mass media communications, newspapers, radio, films, videos, TV, ideas and values are being promoted that are transforming history. The media can be used to inspire great sacrifice and service. It can also influence people to commit terrible acts of cruelty and carnage. Dr. Ted Baer, missionary to Hollywood, says, whoever controls the media controls the culture. John Locke said, whoever defines the word defines the world. And William Shakespeare said, the pen is mightier than the sword. I certainly believe that. We have invested a lot in literature. There's a lot of books and tracts out there. We believe in the power of the pen. We also believe in the power of digital media. That's why we're using video projectors and laptops and PowerPoints and DVDs and using the websites and radio as well, because media is powerful and it's effective and there's nothing wrong with it, and it should be taken over and used for the glory of God. Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci was a co-founder of the Italian Communist Party. Gramsci declared that to capture the Christian West, you needed to Marxize the inner man, to alter the Christian mind, to turn it into its opposite in all its details, so that it would become not merely a non-Christian mind, but an anti-Christian mind. This means getting individuals to think about life's problems without any reference to Christianity and the laws of God. So Gramsci advocated a quiet revolution. Everything must be done in the name of man's dignity and rights, and in the name of his autonomy and freedom from outside restraint, from the claims and constraints of Christianity above all. You'll notice, you can talk about religion, you can even talk about God, but the moment you bring up Jesus Christ, the Bible, or the law of God, now you start to get negative reaction. Gramsci's slogan was, capture the culture. And many Marxists in Hollywood continue their long march through the institutions of the West using art to influence politics. We can show you a lot of examples of it. Actress Jane Fonda, in Agnes of God, God was the bad guy, God was the villain, and Agnes was the victim. She was a nun, and Jane Fonda was the psychologist seeking to rescue this nun from God, because God was actually the villain. Director Costa Gravis, who did Betrayed in the Music Box, they designed their films to attack Christianity or to promote atheism or even communism. Martin Scorsese directed The Last Temptation of Christ, without doubt the most blasphemous Antichrist movie ever made, and Cape Fear. And Paul Schrader, who was the scriptwriter of The Last Temptation and Showgirls, both used to be theological students. They're apostates. Scorsese is an apostate whose intense hatred for Christianity is vented in his vile films. Take Cape Fear, a remake of a 1960s film where the hero was a Bible-believing, God-fearing father who protected his family and was an honorable man. In the modern Cape Fear, he's an adulterer, he's an abusive parent, he's a bad person, so on. And the criminal rapist is a born-again, tongue-speaking, spirit-filled pagan who's got scripture verses all tattooed around his body, a big crucifix on his back. They zoom in on it a lot of time. The remake turns the bad guy into a Christian who literally, when he's about to rape the attorney's wife, says, "Are you ready to be born again? By the time I'm finished with you, you'll be speaking in tongues." That's a kind of twisted, vile, imaginative garbage that they're now injecting into films that the original film had no such content, but in the hands of someone like Martin Scorsese, he'll turn even a film that exalts a God-fearing, God-honoring family man protecting his family from a vile criminal into totally inverting reality and making good evil and evil good. Dr. Ted Baer, the media wise family, has documented some of the tragic consequences of this irresponsible and exploitative media diet of immorality and violence. 13-year-old Eric Smith, who loved reading Stephen King novels and watching gruesome slasher horror films, he lured a 4-year-old, Derek Robey, into the woods, bludgeoned his head with rocks, sodomized a dead body. Where did he get that from? He got it from the movies. Scott Edward Mayer, 17-year-old, obsessed with slasher horror films, the occult and heavy metal music, attacked a girl during the first date. As she closed her eyes for a goodnight kiss, he stabbed her. He had just seen the movie The Cutting Edge. May told the police he had an urge to kill since childhood. "I like knives. I like to go to the movies a lot. A lot of people get stabbed in the movies. I really like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. A lot of people got stabbed in that." 15-year-old Jason Lewis murdered his parents. Police found that Lewis worshipped Satan, and along with 3 of his friends, they had formulated a plan to kill all their parents and copy the cross-country murder spree portrayed in Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers. After being arrested for murdering an 82-year-old man, Christopher Smith, an 18-year-old, shouted at the TV cameras, "I'm a natural-born killer," which is echoing the very words of Woody Harrelson in the movie Natural Born Killers. That same week that Silence of the Lambs won the Academy Award for Best Picture, a young man decapitated his handicapped mother and yelled, "I'm Hannibal the Cannibal," as the police led him away. These are just a few of many examples you can give. After watching Jungle Fever, a 13-year-old boy raped his 8-year-old female cousin. Because that's what you've just seen in the film. Dr. Robert Kuby, in Media Use and Its Implications, in that study he noted that the primary message of the media seems to be materialism. For everything there's a quick fix. It can normally be fixed in 2 hours or less. Young is better. Violence is acceptable. Sex is only good outside of marriage. Religion is unacceptable. Research has indicated that people over 40 years old watch an average of 6 films at the theatre a year, most of which are all age or family films. But teenagers watch an average of 50 films a year in cinemas, 80% of which are age-restricted. Teenagers also watch another 50 movies a year on video. In fact, according to the studies, age-restricted movies are more watched by the people under age than over the age, across the board. This, by the way, does not include broadcast television, video games, computer games, CDs, comics, magazines, and the internet. That's a whole other story. Music television, or MTV, available in some homes by satellite, is by far the worst form of media for teenagers. MTV averages 1,500 sexual acts or references to sex per hour. There is no media in the world so saturated as MTV with vile, unacceptable conduct. Matthew Broderick said, I often wonder, do movies influence the world, or does the world influence movies? What's influencing us more than we know is MTV. No less an authority than Ted Turner, who owned CNN, declared, everything we expose to influence us. Those violent films influence us, and the TV programs influence us. The weaker your family is, the more they influence you. The problems with families in our cities is catastrophic, but when you put violent programs before people who haven't had a lot of love in their lives, who are angry anyway, it's like pouring gasoline on the fire. Well, he should know. Over 3,000 psychiatric, psychological, medical, pediatric, sociological studies have researched the effects of the mass media on behavior, and the influence of the mass media on violent behavior is now so thoroughly documented as to be irrefutable. There is no question whatsoever that the media influences violence, crime, and all the rest of it. Nobody can question that anymore. Coca-Cola doesn't spend multiplied millions a year on short adverts if what you see doesn't influence what you do. If a 30-second advert is going to influence your buying actions and decisions, then what do you think a 90-minute or 2-hour movie is going to do? Even media executives are now acknowledging the media's role in contributing to violence in society. Michael Medved, an Orthodox Jew, is a famous movie critic in the United States. He reported this humorous true story, which gives you a disturbing insight into the thinking of many decision makers in Hollywood. He said, after I criticized the irresponsible behavior of the movie industry, one panelist, furious, replied, while Hollywood is always blamed for the bad it does, it's never given credit for the positive impact. You don't acknowledge that a movie like Lethal Weapon 3 saved thousands of lives, he said. I couldn't recall a life-giving message in this blood-splattered thriller, so I asked what he meant. And he said, well, just before this car chase, which, by the way, included irresponsible things like driving a car straight through a building, right through offices and everything else like that, there was an intense 3-second close-up of Danny Glover and Mel Gibson clicking in the safety belts. He was suggesting that what people saw, they would immediately imitate what they saw for 3 seconds, but the rest of the movie's ultra-violent 118 minutes would have no influence at all. Isn't that contradiction illogical and absurd? But that's exactly what these Hollywood characters try to suggest. You get films like Robin Hood, Kevin Costner's Prince of Thieves. You get all kinds of strange films with all manner of messages. But of course, most films aren't that blatant. Most scriptwriters, directors, and actors don't have such an obsessive anti-Christian axe to grind. Most are far more subtle, but they still have a message. Nor can you rely upon age restrictions as a reliable guide. Even all-age family films can contain anti-Christian messages. Many Disney animated films are full of witches and goblins and demons and sorcerers and spells and genies, but there's scarcely a mention of God in any Disney film. If prayer is depicted, then invariably it's not to God, but to wish upon a star. If you've ever tried it, you'll find out it doesn't work. Think of Avatar, one of the most expensive films ever made in history. What's the name Avatar? It's a Hindu word for a manifestation of some deity who takes possession of a human body and controls it. It's basically what we would call demon possession. But an avatar is a Hindu concept, and they're taking, and in fact the film is totally consistent with New Age humanism and Hinduism. And in it, you've got such gravity-defying things as floating mountains. Even though anyone who falls out of a plane will fall to their death, so there's still gravity affecting the people, just doesn't affect the mountains that are floating in the sky. And you've got creatures that look just like the Indians. In fact, the whole way they talk and they act and the way they greet and the way they talk about the Great Spirit and so on, they plainly are like the Indians of North America, the North American Indians. And it's plain that the bad guys are the capitalists and the evil human beings who come in to try and exploit their planet. A lot of these characters actually look very demonic. In a blatant distortion of history, Pocahontas is twisted by Disney into promoting New Age humanism. In fact, the main reason Pocahontas is famous is because she was the first Indian convert to Christianity to be baptized in North America. Not that anybody seen a Disney film would ever know that. This is the oil painting, huge oil painting, massive, bigger than this whole wall, up in the rotunda at the U.S. Congress, of Pocahontas, this Indian princess, being converted to Christ. But in the Disney movie, instead of the 12-year-old girl who was in, who was around when John Smith comes along, you have someone who definitely doesn't look like she's 12 years old, and you've got John Smith and her in some romantic relationship which never happened, and there's no hint of her relationship to Christ or her conversion to Christ. She talks to the tree, she talks to Mother Willow. Funnily enough, it's the only animated Disney film ever, I'm told, where the animals don't speak. None of the animals speak. Not the hummingbird, the badger, raccoon, none of them. But the trees talk. Mother Willow talks. See, there's Grandma Willow. She talks. The animals can't talk, but the trees talk. And Pocahontas talks to the trees. This is slanderous. It's against the sister in Christ, the mother in the faith, who loved the Lord, and in this movie it's promoting New Age paganism. We need to understand our history. If we don't understand our history, we will be distorted in our understanding of what's happened in the past. So many films today say this is a true story, or based on a true story. Yeah, right. The names of the places are true, it's just the facts that have been changed to protect the guilty. How true is Kevin Costner's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, to history? Not at all. In this film, none of the Christians have any Christianity at all. The only person with any religious anything in the movie is the one Muslim who turns up in England in the 12th century with gunpowder in the 12th century. You've got to be kidding. But hey, Hollywood has to do something to make up for lack of scripts and character development and dialogue, so they've got to have explosions. And this is just pathetic. You have this Muslim giving all kinds of speeches in England in the 12th century and lots of pyrotechnics, which of course would not have been possible with the technology available at that time. The modern Robin Hood, you would think, would be better. In some ways it is. But it's got an absolutely inexplicable anti-Christian twist and pro-Muslim twist. How do you get a pro-Muslim message into Robin Hood? Well, just like the previous Robin Hood of Kevin Costner managed, Ridley Scott, who did Gladiator, and Gladiator managed to have AD without JC. There was no Jesus, there was no Christianity, there wasn't a single Christian in the movie. 2 centuries after Christ, there you've got the most intense persecution of Christians, and they're not even in the arena as lion bait. Ridley Scott also produced Kingdom of Heaven, the most anti-Christian, pro-Muslim film ever produced. And so, in this one, Robin Hood, where you think you're going to see a nice Robin Hood movie, he's still got to put in some nasty, anti-Christian, pro-Muslim twist. And although this film is vastly superior and much better with some redeemable features, definitely superior to the previous one done by Kevin Costner, but in this one, it, for some reason, trashes one of the most beloved characters in English history, and that's Richard the Lionheart. Richard the Lionheart is one of the most courageous people in history. He was honored in his time as the Lionheart. He was revered and respected not only by his own men, but by the enemy. To this day, the Muslims respect Richard the Lionheart. Here's Richard the Lionheart being shown charging into the middle of the Saracens with his battle axe and a shield with the lion on it, courageous and principled above all of his contemporaries. And yet in this movie, it tries to make him guilty of murdering Muslim women and children, which never happened. Absolute lie, twisted nonsense. And why does Ridley Scott have to slip these sort of things in his movies? Well, he's made clear he's anti-Christian. He said he's an agnostic, and he's twisted all of the storms to put in an anti-Christian bias, but to do something against one of the only people who has a statue within the grounds of the British House of Commons and House of Lords. In the Palace of Westminster, there's only two statues, Oliver Cromwell's and Richard the Lionheart. And by the way, Richard the Lionheart's flag, his Crusader flag, the St. George's Cross, which became the flag of England. If you notice in the most recent Soccer World Cup, it was the English flag, the red cross on white. That's the flag that was flown by Richard the Lionheart, the Crusader king, who out of 11 years as king of England, was away from England for most of it. He was only in England for 4 months of the 11 years he was the king. He even offered to sell London to finance one of his crusades, the Holy Land. So you can kind of see where his priorities were. He was the Crusader king. And because he beat the Muslims honorably, Ridley Scott has to try and trash his character with fictional garbage. And you can see the flag is still there with Richard Lionheart's Crusader banner in the middle. How true is this film to history? King Arthur, irredeemable garbage. There's not anything vaguely historical in this film. Instead of King Arthur, one of the most beloved Celtic heroes of English history, in this one he's a Roman. So, the greatest English king just happens to be a Roman. Well, that doesn't help. And his merry men, his knights of the round table, they're Russians. No, not an Englishman amongst these great Celtic warriors at all. Round table, smack in the middle of some Roman camp. Why? What's the point? As for Merlin, he's a druid. And the real enemies here, the evil demonic Saxons, who, being sea warriors, for some reason decided to attack north of Hadrian's Wall, even though they attacked the south of England. Hence you have Sussex, Wessex and Essex. West Saxons, East Saxons, South Saxons. But no, they attack north of Hadrian's Wall, the most phenomenal, formidable military obstacle ever built in the ancient world, and they decide to attack through Hadrian's Wall from the north, even though there were sea warriors who could have landed the ship south of Hadrian's Wall. Why would they do that? It didn't happen anyway. Still, this woman in the middle here happens to be rescued from the Inquisition. All this in 4th century Britain, which is about 6 centuries before the Inquisition started. And she got all her fingers broken by the nasty Inquisition, and yet she's able to handle a bow and arrow with deadly accuracy immediately afterwards. Extraordinary recovery that. In this film, you have nothing logical or rational. Even the Saxons, who've just come by sea, don't know as much about ice and water and how much weight ice can take before they crack and form to it. It's just absolutely bizarre. And we won't say anything about this Guinevere, who's meant to be some princess, and her battle bikini. But this is the kind of rubbish that Hollywood's dishing up. I don't know what they're thinking. How true is this film to history? Alexander is nauseating homosexual propaganda. He tries to portray one of the greatest military heroes of all time, Alexander the Great, as some homo. Even though he was married twice, somehow in this he's made some kind of lover boy homo, which apparently is one of the most nauseating on-screen kisses of two males ever. And it's only got two little battles. It's meant to be one of the greatest soldiers of all time. It gives you not the slightest clue. Now, the Richard Burton one of Alexander the Great, which came out 50 years ago, is far more accurate, far more true to the character with real character development. What about Braveheart? Braveheart is mostly accurate, but it's got some weird things in it. For example, it suddenly makes Sir William Wallace into some commoner peasant in some mud hut, even though his father was a knight and he was a knight. But hey, Hollywood just loves this business of having the common masses, and so they don't really let you know how he studied overseas and travelled to Rome and how he could speak French and Latin and everything else fluently. They rather have him into some painted savage. And in this film, William Wallace, who was renowned as being 6'6", he's played by someone who's fairly short, the Battle of Stirling Bridge is without the bridge. There's no bridge for some reason. And they have a few other strange things. When William Wallace had his wife, or his fiancée, we're not sure because it was probably a secret marriage, but his noble wife was murdered by the sheriff. He went and he killed every single man in the stone castle, worked his way up the stone castle and killed the sheriff. He did this alone, and it was a stone castle, not this little wickety wooden fence thing with a couple of dirty soldiers in it, with a popular French Revolution uprising of the peasants with him. That's fiction. William Wallace, on his own, took on a stone castle and killed everybody in it in revenge when his wife was murdered. You would have thought that it stuck to the reality because the history is more incredible than the fiction. Should have just stuck to the facts. Edward Longshanks was no doubt a ruthless man. He's known as the Hammer of the Scots, but I think they might have overdone it because he was a great crusader. He is the man who introduced the Parliament to England, which can't make him all bad. Joan of Arc, child of war, soldier of God, this film is actually quite good. But The Messenger is pretty demonic. This version of Joan of Arc, honestly, this woman looks demon-possessed. And it's a very vile, strange twist of a person who's been renowned as one of the purest characters and one of the most honorable saints in church history. And for The Messenger to turn her into this deeply troubled person. Ooh. How true is the Patriot to history? Mostly. Almost all of the Patriot is good, accurate, honest and fair, but there's one inexplicable, ahistoric piece of anachronistic garbage thrown into it that you wonder what they were thinking. They show at one gut-wrenching sequence in the film, British soldiers burning a church with civilians, even women and children in the church. That never happened. There's no case of British, German, or any other Western troops ever burning people in the church alive. Just unheard of. That's what communists have done in the 20th century. That's what Muslims do to this day. I've documented that sort of thing being done everywhere from Mozambique through to Sudan. It was never done in the American War of Independence. Why did they have to put such an ahistoric piece of garbage into the film? It ruins an otherwise excellent film. How true is the Four Feathers to history? I was keen to see this film because it's on Sudan. But it has cavalry officers who suddenly are in the Camel Corps, who suddenly are commanding infantry. Now listen, those are three totally separate sections of the army. It's impossible that a cavalry officer would suddenly be commanding infantry or would suddenly be in the Camel Corps. It's, you know, you've got to make up your mind. They're either cavalry or they're Camel Corps or they are infantry. In this film, they're all three. The spiritual heart of the film is a Nuban, a black Nuban, who's depicted as a Muslim. And this script was written by a born-again Christian. I despair when Christians can produce such a twisted script. Every white soldier in the British Army is depicted as faithless without any religion. The only one who's depicted as a Bible-believing Jesus freak is a coward and a fool who prays for courage, loses his mind, runs around and gets shot by his own army after having prayed for courage. Which, why would they do that? And this is a Christian scriptwriter. And the Nubians have been Christians for centuries, holding out against Muslims, and that they, if there is a Muslim Nuban, I haven't met him, and I've been to Nuban Mountains a number of times. But anyway, in this film, they have this Nuban Muslim. They have the Battle of Abu Klay, which was a great British victory, where 600 British Camel Corps managed to break an attack of 10,000 Dervish Muslims. In this film, the Dervishes win, the British lose. How can you twist that? They have this, where's the camels? Every one of the 600 men were part of the Camel Corps. Battle of Abu Klay, zero camels. I don't know, maybe they didn't have the budget for camels, but whatever the reason is, it wasn't infantry then. And it wasn't a British defeat. It was a British victory. And they just twist these things. Absolutely disappointing. The Four Feathers. It could have been a good film. In fact, the original Four Feathers, made about 50 years before, was far more accurate. They don't mention in the film why they were going to Sudan, which was to rescue General Charles Gordon, the most outstanding evangelical Christian, who was standing against slavery and who had freed the slaves of southern Sudan and who died trying to protect the people of southern Sudan from the Arab slave traders. Well, I've written about this at great length in our Faith and Defiance Sudan book because that's been a large part of our work. Joy to Noel is an amazingly, wonderfully unusual film that is God-honoring, Christ-centered. It's a true story about the Christmas truce that started in the trenches in Belgium in 1914. The German trenches, which you can see were curved, and the British trenches, which were very rectangular, were bombarding one another, but they stopped on Christmas Eve, and the German trenches put Christmas trees on the top, started singing Silent Night. The Australians on the other side joined in, and it started and rippled through the whole of the Western Front, and both sides laid down arms, came out in the middle. At this point, this is where it started. And here, a cross was put up by the Australians on the 85th anniversary of this, remembering this great event when on this battlefield, people laid aside their hostility and their hatred, and on the birthday of Christ, they sang hymns, they prayed, and the next day they played soccer together. And notice the soccer balls that have been put at the cross here. Well, this film looks at one part of that Christmas truce, and it's absolutely remarkable. It's Christ-honoring, and this was a sketch done by somebody who was actually there, by the way, 85 years before, and they put up this memorial. Well, this is all true. However, in the film, the only complaint I can put about it is that the minister who leads them in prayer is not a German Lutheran, nor is he an Anglican or Methodist chaplain. He's a Roman Catholic Scotsman. For goodness sakes, does nobody know that Scotland is like 99.9% Presbyterian? In 1914, when would you find a Scottish Roman Catholic chaplain? Are they kidding? Maybe the French would have had a Roman Catholic chaplain, but the Germans were the ones who started the truce. It would have been a Lutheran chaplain leading, but you know, something about Hollywood, they don't like Protestants. They can handle a nominee party. They like this Roman Catholic Latin stuff because at least they don't have to hear the gospel or the scripture being read. It's in Latin. We don't know Latin, so that's okay. I just thought that was quite bizarre that this otherwise excellent film would have inserted a Roman Catholic Scotsman into an event which was dominated by Protestants on both sides. But anyway, other than that, a good reminder of how Christ could even come to the worst times of insanity and bring some peace. Flyboys is a piece of junk. There is nothing accurate or honest about this. This is a twisted piece of garbage from Hollywood with the most unrealistic nonsense. First of all, it's meant to be 1916, and you've got German triplanes, even though they were only invented in 1918. And every one of the Germans is flying a red triplane, even though only Baron von Richthofen had a red one, and he only painted it red at the end of 1917. But they've got 1916, all the Germans have red triplanes, which is rubbish. And it's only in the latter part of 1918 that the squadron of Baron von Richthofen painted all their triplanes red, because everyone was gunning for Baron von Richthofen, so to spread the risk. And flyboys, for some reason, just twisted out of all proportion. And they depict some things honestly, and then other things they depict totally dishonestly. This is the reality of the First World War. Here you've got an Austrian plane that had just sunk an Italian submarine, dropping lifeboats to help the soldiers who had, the sailors who were otherwise going to drown, and some Austrian planes have landed to help save the Italians and give them lifeboats. That's the sort of thing that did happen. In the First World War, you did have cases, which is depicted in Flyboys inconsistently, that when the one man's gun jammed, a German pilot came alongside, saluted him, and let him go. He goes, "Hey, your guns are jammed. We won't continue with the fight." But then inexplicably, it puts an ahistoric rubbish of having the Luftwaffe shooting up a pilot who's been shot down, survived on the ground, and he's standing by the side of his plane, and he was strafed, machine gunned while on the ground. That never happened. That's just ahistoric. These people, honorable people, people like the Red Baron, throwing, going and visiting when there's one of the enemy having a burial service and dropping the
wreath
of flowers on the grave while flying over ahead. And, you know, the other side was refraining from using anti-aircraft fire because they realized they were just paying their respects to one of their honorable enemy. So the film has got some inexplicable things where they even have the most bizarre part of the flyboys is, if you've ever seen what the battle scenes were like over there, they poured mega tons of explosives in every square foot of the battlefield. There's no such thing as a smooth runway between the lines. And yet in this film, where one of his friends, this key American, crash lands in the middle of in no man's land between the German lines and the French lines, and he goes and lands in no man's land. That's not possible. Do you know how many barbed wire obstacles, how many millions of craters of bombs? You could not do that. How could you land a plane in the middle of a bomb-strewn, obstacle-crossing, barbed wire-strewn field and then take off again? Ah! This is ridiculous. No wonder they didn't show him actually landing, just showed the before and after. But it's this sort of rubbish. But then he has this takeoff and landing at night, which you couldn't do in the First World War. They had no night takeoff and landing capability for their fighters. And he goes and lands on a field by a farmhouse because the lines have moved and now his girlfriend, his French girlfriend, is behind the lines. Well, so what? There was no targeting of civilians in the First World War. And he goes and endangers her life, gets in a plane, she gets shot because they're taking off and people are wondering, you know, who's taking off in the dark. And all this drama for nothing. Why would he endanger life? Not that he could have landed on a farm field in the dark anyway, or taken off from it. It's just absolutely an insult to intelligence. Why do they make films like that? Maybe because they think the people watching the films are stupid and can't think. The Red Baron is disappointing because it puts the whole film around fiction. It doesn't stick to the facts of what the Red Baron was and what he did. One of the greatest pilot, or the greatest fighter pilot in history. And you don't get to know anything about him. They put the whole film around a fictional romance with a French nurse, which didn't happen, and so on. In fact, the Red Baron was an amazing person, and you would never know it from the film. What a pity that they spent millions on making a film like that. If anyone's ever seen The African Queen, Humphrey Bogart, Katharine Hepburn, it's a fun film. It just is, it's based on completely ahistoric garbage. It has the German army in East Africa burning a mission station, which never happened. General van Lettler Voorbeek, who ran the East African campaign, was an honorable enemy. He beat General Smuts, he beat General Rigoberto. Everyone honored him. He ended the war victorious. The British had to come over with a red white flag and say, the war's over in Europe, hand in your weapons. And they said, you never beat us in the battlefield. Have a rematch. Okay, you can keep your weapons. And General van Lettler Voorbeek marched the East African army back to Germany through the Brandenburg Gates for the victory parade. The only victory parade under the Brandenburg Gates after the First World War of a German army unit. Because they won. They were never beaten and there wasn't one atrocity. It was a clean war. And to think that this Hollywood movie could fictionalize atrocities that never happened. Indiana Jones is even worse. Indiana Jones dishonors the Africa Corps and makes them the ultimate baddies. Now, my father fought the Africa Corps. My father was in the 8th Army. He was fighting under Montgomery against Rommel's Africa Corps. And to his dying day, my father would never allow someone to say something dishonorable about Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, Africa Corps. And yet, in the Indiana Jones movies, they turn the Africa Corps uniform into the enemy. The Africa Corps didn't exist before 1941. To put that uniform in British Egypt in 1936, 1937 is ridiculous. It didn't happen. And Egypt was run by the British. How did you suddenly have the Africa Corps in British colony before the war, before they existed? And then they had them as a bunch of goose-stepping Nazis, which they weren't. They were an honorable bunch of people. And my professor at Theological College was African Corps man who prayed every night through his time in the war. He said, Erwin Rommel was a born-again, Bible-believing man, God-fearing man. And that's what my father and others knew too. The Patton movie is pretty good, fairly accurate, but it doesn't give as much of his God-fearing Christian faith in it as it deserves. It does give some honor to God over the answer to prayer in the Battle of the Bulge. It doesn't do justice to his hostility to the communists at the end. It just touches on it. And it doesn't even mention how he was murdered by the American High Command at the end of the war, when General Patton resigned his commission in protest over what was being done in Europe and how the communists were being strengthened and aided. And he said, "We've fought the wrong enemy. The communists are a real enemy. I can't believe we helped this Soviet scum." And they left most of that out, and the fact that he got assassinated at the end of his very spectacular flamboyant life. About the most accurate war film I think I've ever seen is The Great Raid. This is a 1945 January incredible battle and a true film, which this film amazingly sticking to details. This is the way film should be made. It's actually accurate and honorable and decent. In any film, you should ask, who's the hero? In Troy, it's obvious who the hero is. Brad Pitt playing Achilles. Achilles is actually a reprehensible character, a very vile character. If you read the history of Achilles, he was a rapist, murdering, nasty individual with no redeeming features. In this movie, he's the hero. Paris, who's the hero of the film, of the story, in that he kills Achilles, he's trashed as some little cowardly wimp. And yet, Paris is the one who killed Achilles, who's meant to be the greatest warrior of all time. And yet, in this movie, because you've got a modern Hollywood idol playing an ancient Greek idol, they've got a trash Paris, who was the one who beat Achilles after all. And Homer's Iliad makes it clear that Helen of Troy, the face that launched a thousand ships, had jet black hair and green eyes. So in the modern film, she's got blonde hair and blue eyes. Okay, well, I suppose that's just the way Hollywood's going these days. They don't really do justice to the war. You'd think this battle happens in 10 days. In fact, it took 10 years. Hector gets a fair showing, but it leaves out the great chariot fight between him and Achilles. And the battles are pretty well depicted in many ways. But it just twists so much of the story. Who's the hero in Invictus? Well, obviously Nelson Mandela is the hero. In fact, this is modern idol worship in an interesting way. Notice how at first you got the fist raised, and then somebody decided to bring another one up to make it look less communist, you see? Like, yeah, boxing, something, jiving. This is the reality with the clenched fist, the communist loop. But you don't get that in Clint Eastwood's movie, because Clint Eastwood is making modern mythology. And so he makes the most wonderful grandfatherly figure that every one of us would want to vote for. I mean, this is a paid political advertisement for the ANC. And in this film, the most disturbing thing is how Matt Damon's character trashes the Christian testimony of François Pina. François Pina is a born-again, Bible-believing, God-fearing man. A man who gave all honor to Christ for the victory in this World Cup. And yet in this movie, they make no mention of Jesus Christ. They put all honor on the present. When in the history of the world has any sports team's victory on the field been attributed to their estate? Does the Queen of England or the Prime Minister of England or the President of America get the credit when their team wins something or an Olympic medal? This is amazing that they portray the Springboks as a bunch of losers who have no chance. What they don't show is how the Springboks beat the Australians in the first match of the test and knocked them out. The Australians were the main favourites. Everyone expected the Australians to win, and the Springboks beat them in the first match. They mentioned why? They're trying to have it that this hopeless team is going to be pulled together by His Excellency Saint Nelson Mandela, who's the one who omnisciently... You kind of wonder why he didn't help the final win the soccer World Cup, because he apparently could help the rugby guys win the World Cup then. This is really hagiography, you know, when they write new sainthood. I think one of the most brilliant, clever, intelligent, smart moves ever made by Nelson Mandela was putting on the Springbok green and gold and identifying with the winning team at the World Cup. That was a good move, and it did unite the country in many ways, and it was greatly respected and admired. But in the movie, they portray François Pina as swearing during the movie. And he said it never happened. He never swore. And it also depicts François Pinault's character is fornicating with his fiancée the night before the match. And as she and he said, that never happened. That just Clint Eastwood's. Why must Clint Eastwood always inject some immoral anti-Christian junk in his movies? Honestly. And at the end of it, you see why you've got the title Invictus. Because Nelson Mandela quotes a humanistic poem: to whatever gods there are, I declare, I am the captain of my soul, I'm the master of my fate. And Invictus, the name of this humanistic poem, is a very anti-God, anti-Christian poem, and it's the key thing of the film. So the story of how this Christian Springboks, and by the way, the Springboks met every night, every match, before the match, on their knees in prayer, after every match in prayer. In this film, they don't show that. They just show at the end them getting on their knees and saying, Chester, why didn't you lead us in prayer? Thanks, Lord, for letting us win the match. That's rubbish. This was the most electric, most exciting moment and prayer of their lives. And as they said, they didn't thank God for winning the match. They praised, they said we would have got on their knees and thanked him no matter what the outcome came. We're thanking God for the privilege we had of being part of this match. We thanked him after every match, even the ones that we lost. And in this movie, instead of François Pinault leading them in prayer, he passes on to Chester, and there's this light, meaningless little, oh, thanks for letting us win the match, which is absolutely ahistoric twisting of history. And they transfer all the praise of Christ through to a political leader who is not known for his Christian testimony. In fact, what the film leaves out is why Nelson Mandela was in prison. There's a lot in the film about how he's locked up. An impression is given that he's locked up because he's against apartheid. But Desmond Tutu was against apartheid. He has never been in prison. There's many people against apartheid and didn't end up in prison. He's in prison for violence. The Cold War context is left out. There's just one side of the story given. They don't tell you that there was a Cold War going on, which was very hot in Southern Africa. Marxist revolutionaries were infiltrating and taking over one country after the other. Soviet warships were around our coast and in Maputo and Luanda Harbor. Soviet generals and field marshals were in neighboring states and the frontline states. Tens of thousands of Cuban troops were being poured off the ships. Cuban tanks by the thousands were in our neighboring countries. We were fighting tank battles, aerial battles. We had goose-stepping Cuban troops in Luanda. Soviet missiles on the border. It was a very serious, real war going on. And to make it out that there were just some mean white people who put Mandela in prison for no good reason isn't fair. That's just not true. There was a war going on. People were dying, and it was a real threat. One third of the world was behind the Iron Curtain, and as people were oppressed, the church was being destroyed. And when we went across the border, could take pictures like this, Russian P-76 amphibious tank through the window, some South African troops there. You could see Leonid Brezhnev and Fidel Castro's pictures on the floor. Sort of dates this. And, of course, this was a terrorist training camp, and picture captured showing two Russian commissars training SWAPO and ANC terrorists in Angola with the Marx brothers on the wall. Engels, Marx, and Lenin, and even the Vietnamese flag. Angola was a Soviet satellite. Civilization built up over 500 years was being destroyed. People being put against trees and shot without trial. Rhodesia was under attack on all sides. People were being murdered by the thousands. By landmines, hands tied behind their backs with wire and shot and stabbed in the back. None of this is depicted in Invictus. They leave out all the context of what was going on, which is the murder of missionaries, of Red Cross ambulance drivers, hacking those off of ears and lips, women being forced to cook and eat their own lips because they spoke against the communists. These are people killed by Robert Mugabe's own terrorist missionaries and babies murdered at the Ila Mission massacre in Zimbabwe. This is what was going on in our farming roads. Landmines planted in the roads. This is what SWAPO and ANC were doing. And to sort of depict that a bunch of nice, pleasant, toy-toying people smiling going down the road was what was the issue is not true. There's real weapons, real violence, and it was part of a communist international campaign. These are the communist members of the ANC, the control from the Soviet Union, all the different tanks and trucks and helicopters and gunships and supersonic jet aircraft and attack helicopters and surface air missiles, the thousands going into sub-Saharan Africa for attack on our country. This is just factual. Soviet flags are being used in our country. This is a result of the bomb blast in Joburg. A young girl, a smiling bomber, put the bomb right under her grandmother and her grandchild, who were the worst burned. 23 people burned, a suitcase full of petrol, dynamite, and a time bomb. Church Street bombing. This is the sort of thing the ANC was doing. But they don't mention the people being killed in landmines, limpet mines, car bombs. This was the context. And if this was given, people wouldn't be, oh, what a wonderful person, what a great president. That's just fiction. It's political junk. And this is what the reality was. Stick grenades. Soviet Cyrillic script on the right, on the left, and the Chinese script on the right. The Magoo bomb. And the man who did this bombing became chief of police in Johannesburg, wasn't it? There were a lot of merchants of death. We haven't even talked about the necklace murders, which Winnie Mandela promoted so enthusiastically. Or the Soviet flag, the Red Dawn, the clenched fists, and all the rest. Or the St. James Massacre, murdering of Christians by terrorists bursting and throwing hand grenades on people in the congregation. Or the Shell House Massacre. Where else in history has a president taken responsibility for, yes, I gave the order to shoot unarmed protesters like these Zulus at Shell House and still survived? It's because of political propaganda like Clint Eastwood's trying to make, to deify someone by taking all the context away. It's just not honest. And to trash the Christian testimony of Francois Pina, it's unacceptable. Who's the villain in Matt Damon's Green Zone? Well, the American government. The American government are the bad guys. They're the ones who pick the fight on these poor innocent Iraqis, on poor Saddam Hussein and his peace-loving, mass-murdering, thuggery government in Iraq. And the American government is the evil bad guys. So this is the new villain in Hollywood. They're taking aim at them. Who's the villain in the Kingdom of Heaven? The Christians, all the Christians, without exception. Christians bad, Muslims good. This is Ridley Scott's epic against the Crusaders. He doesn't focus on the Crusaders conquering and liberating Jerusalem in 1099. No, he focuses on when the Crusaders lost Jerusalem in 1187. And it's got such imbecilic things as a crusader who's lugged his hulking great big helmet over 3,000 kilometers, throwing his helmet away just before facing a massive assault from the enemy. Why would you throw your helmet away when you need it? And then he throws the shield away for some reason as well. I suppose he had to have his locks flowing in the wind. And they've got a lot of grit and grime, but it's totally unrealistic nonsense. Just about everything, there is nothing in this film that's accurate. Every single thing in a film is false. The geography, the history, the culture, the language, the personalities. And if you're interested in the details of it, I've written a whole review on this Kingdom of Heaven on our website. And it's also in the Slavery, Terrorism, Islam book. It should take too long to tell you what's wrong with this film. But I could make it simple by saying there's nothing accurate in the film. It makes the Knights Templar, who were the defenders of pilgrims, who were there to defend people from attacks. It makes them the bandits who attacked people traveling to Jerusalem. This is fiction. In fact, as the greatest authority on the Crusades in history, that's Professor Riley Smith in Oxford University, he said he can say with authority, no Knights Templar ever attacked any caravans, ever. It, as he said, the entire film is absolute rubbish. Well, Ridley Scott's got his axe to grind, and we expose that in Slavery, Terrorism, Islam. The Crusaders were reacting to 500 years of Islamic Jihad, and in this form they ignore all the Muslim atrocities, and they just invent Christian atrocities. What's the basic message of the film? Runaway Jury is based on a book by John Grisham. In the book Runaway Jury, a man dies of smoking, lungs cancer after smoking, and his wife sues the cigarette company. In the movie, a man dies from a lunatic who runs amok shooting people, and the wife sues the firearm company that manufactured the gun that this lunatic used. Why did they change the direction? Well, cigarette companies have a lot of money, I guess. And in the film, the basic message of the film is civilians shouldn't have the right to defend themselves. And it's wrong to have weapons. And people who manufacture firearms should be sued for how somebody might abuse it. So that if somebody used a kitchen knife for a murder, maybe you should sue the manufacturer of the kitchen knives. If somebody used a car to crash into somebody, maybe you should sue the motor company that made it. So it's a bit weird. That's the message of this film. Evil, evil, evil guns. Forget about cigarettes. Forget about people. It's the cold, inanimate object that's evil. How's love portrayed? Pearl Harbor's a love story disguised as a war film. Many males went there thinking they'd see a war film, but in fact, mostly it's a love triangle. The history's a bit weird, and in it you've got fighter pilots who become bomber pilots, which also is totally and completely and utterly impossible. It could not happen. You can't get a fighter pilot and suddenly say, oh, we'd like you guys to fly bombs. You've got to spend your life specializing in one or the other. They're totally different and completely different commands. But still, in this film, the love triangle is everything. And how's love portrayed? Very frivolously. There's no marriage, there's no commitment, there's no lifelong commitment in church, there's no marriage at all. Pretty ridiculous. You've got soldiers running on a concrete tarmac while the Japanese are machine gunning the tarmac. Now, concrete doesn't absorb anything. So you get splashed, which means multiple ricochets. If you don't get hit with a bullet, you're going to get hit by pieces of concrete, fragmented. You can't run on concrete while they're machine gunning around. Only in American movies can you run through a hail of machine gun fire on a concrete slab and somehow still be standing and running. It's impossible. You're going to get knocked down flat. It's impossible to keep running on concrete with a machine strafing above. But in Pearl Harbor, these sort of things happen. And the same people who were fighting in the Battle of Britain, were fighting in Pearl Harbor, also flew off aircraft carriers with bombers in order to attack Japan. Very impossible. So, how does the conflict resolve in a film? In Titanic, the conflict resolved by lying, cheating, deceiving, breaking engagements, and living a lie, and all the rest of it. Because everything's fair in love, apparently. And instead of focusing on the many courageous, true testimonies of people who gave up their seats under lifeboats, including evangelical Christians, very courageous, in this film, it's just a class war, and they bring in absolutely false things like the poor people being kept behind bars, not being allowed to go to the boats. Total fiction, never happened. And they injected a class war into this film, which did not happen. And they focused on two fictional characters. Why? You've got 2,500 real people, all with great testimonies that could have been used, but this is Hollywood. Consider the film, consider its characters, consider its message in the light of the facts of history. How's the church portrayed? In Hotel Rwanda, it doesn't exist. Here you've got a Holocaust where 800,000 people, mostly Christians, mostly Protestants, are slaughtered, most of them in churches. And Hotel Rwanda, while it's fairly accurate insofar as it goes, it never tells you why, it never tells you who. It just tells you what. But what it doesn't say is that these were Protestant Christians being targeted. And most of the people were killed in churches. You don't even get these people praying. The funny thing is, even though these people come to the hotel, there's no prayer meeting, there's no singing, there's no hymns, in the middle of a genocide with sounds of genocide going all around, I've stayed in this hotel, and I've documented the atrocities in the Holocaust in Rwanda, and it's just extraordinary that Hollywood stripped it of every last vestige of Christian expression. And it has a very explosive scene, a very ugly, horrible scene, where this Canadian colonel says, the people in the West aren't coming to help you. You know, the whites don't care about you because you're black, you're low, you're dirty, you're Africans. That's not true. Who was the head of the UN? Who was the head of the UN peacekeeping? An Egyptian and a Ghanaian. Two Africans were the two key people making the decisions in Hollywood. UN at that time, and they were sending UN troops to help black Muslims in Somalia. They just wouldn't help black Christians in Rwanda or black Christians in Sudan, but they would help black Muslims in Sudan, in Darfur, but they'd never help black Christians. what he should have said is, "You're Christians, you're lower than dirt." Now that would have been true. But to make it out into, it's just the Europeans are being mean, but the head of the UN at that stage was Boutros Ghali. Why are they letting him off the hook and are blaming the guys in Western Europe for what plainly the United Nations was guilty of? They had the men there, they had the manpower, and they didn't do a thing to protect the people they were responsible for that they had just disarmed. Literally disarmed the people and stood by while 800,000 people were massacred. Well, there's a whole story about Holocaust Rwanda. Much better is Beyond the Gates, which is also known as Shooting Dogs, which is a horrible title, but it's a true film, and it's the first film in Rwanda filmed in Rwanda by a British company, and it's based on a mission station, a Catholic mission station, and you see the prayers depicted, the hymns protected, the Christian faith of the people, and most of the people in the film were Rwandese, and they filmed at an actual mission station where this took place. This is a film with integrity, which shows exactly how the UN betrayed and abandoned the people, and I would recommend that much quicker than Hotel Rwanda. What's the worldview of the film? In Ben-Hur, the worldview is thoroughly biblical. It's a biblical worldview, it's a Christian worldview, and it's the greatest film ever made. Ben-Hur won 11 Academy Awards in a time when there was only about 11 or 12 or so to be had, so it'll never be beaten. They said, oh, we've had a film recently for 11 Academy Awards, yes, but now there's about, what, 40-something different categories. So it's not quite the same thing. Ben-Hur is the most celebrated and successful film in the history of the world, based on a Christ-honoring novel. What's the worldview of Gladiator? Stoicism. Humanism. But it's Stoic humanism. Ridley Scott manages to have AD without JC. And it's very similar to Ben-Hur in this sense. It's got a man who's at the top, a top leader, a prince almost, who then is betrayed and he ends up as a slave, in this case as not rowing in a galley like Ben-Hur, but in the arena as a gladiator, and then he challenges the empire and he moves his way up. Now, it's similar in the basic plot, but what's different is while Ben-Hur is thoroughly biblical in its worldview, Gladiator is thoroughly Stoic. And the interesting thing about it is, who's the number one proponent of Stoicism? Marcus Aurelius, the emperor who's depicted in this film as such a wonderful man. Even secular historians say he was the worst persecutor of the Christians of all the Roman emperors. Marcus Aurelius put more Christians in the arena, killed more Christians than any other Roman emperor. And yet in this film, Ridley Scott makes him out to be the most wonderful, grandfatherly, Nelson Mandela-y type of Invictus character you could imagine. You'd all just want to hug and vote for him any day. I mean, Marcus Aurelius, this is the emperor that killed more Christians than any other, and yet they depict him as being a really nice person. Why would they do that? Because Ridley Scott's just got a real axe to grind against Christianity, that's what. And while it's got some great action sequences and there's many good features about it, yet the film leaves you ultimately empty, because Stoicism is a fatalistic, empty, humanistic ideology. And while it's got 50 years advance on Ben-Hur in terms of technological things available, it isn't as satisfying a movie as Ben-Hur, because its worldview is empty. It's Stoicism. And so, what's the point, indeed? Well, it's slightly imaginative too, because the king, the emperor, Commodus, was killed by a sister, actually. But that's another story. Colossians 2 verse 8 says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world. Who will rise up for me against the wicked? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? Have nothing to do with the fruitless seeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things." There's a model for what we should be aiming for in our movies. We want to see the true and noble and right and pure and lovely and admirable, excellent, praiseworthy. And there are some films like it. Not many, but there are. We should be selective. We need to clean the screen. Here's some positives we can do. It's important that we recognize that immoral, violent, occultic, pagan films, videos and DVDs and TV shows, magazines and computer games, they present a serious threat to Christian civilization. We should boycott such. Number two, we need to read up on the biblical issues and the actual history so that we can recognize deception in the media. Read the MediaWise Family by Dr. Ted Baer, subscribe to Movie Guide, and we've got some great history books and magazines on the table that will help you. But Movie Guide is run by Dr. Ted Baer. Pray for him. He's got a wonderful ministry of being an advocate for pro-family moral issues of the movies. You can see here him here with Pat Boone and quite a lot of key stars and famous people. Chuck Norris has come to Christ. He was 8 years in a row world karate champion, unbeaten for 8 years, and never beaten. And he's a Bible-believing Christian now and takes part in Movie Guide as well. We can point out quite a few. They're doing a good work. You can always look on movieguide.org and check on any movie. Know before you go. Don't waste your time on rubbish. Number three, you can obtain some video documentaries that will help alert your family and friends and congregation to the deceptions and dangers in films. There's Hollywood versus Religion, really good. Learn to Discern, Top Class, Hell's Bells, MediaWise Family, Death by Entertainment. We've got a lot of these at Christian Liberty Books as well. We are to teach my people the difference between the holy and the common, and to show how to distinguish between unclean and the clean. We all need discernment. Number four, be selective in your viewing choices. Take control over what's filling and forming your mind. Rediscover the joy of reading great books. There's some great books out there. There's a lot more truth in an average book than is an average film. Set proper priorities. Relegate films and videos to a subordinate position below exercise, hiking, worship, fellowship, evangelism, and service. There's a place for films. We're going to show a film just now, but it's never had it at the top. Number five, refuse to waste your time or your money on immoral, anti-Christian films. Rather choose to support good quality films that honor God, like Ben-Hur and The Robe and The Ten Commandments and Chariots of Fire, The Mission, First Light, Christie, Prince of Egypt, Gods and Generals. There's some great films that have been made and that we should be supporting and which are top class. South Africa's own Faith Like Potatoes, Facing the Giants, which is a phenomenally God-honoring film produced by a church film ministry which has gone on to producing even better films since. The Passion of the Christ, which is absolutely extraordinary in giving the most accurate and biblical depiction of the sufferings of Christ and the crucifixion. Absolutely relentless, but a very effective evangelistic tool, especially with Muslims. Amazing Grace on William Wilberforce and his fight against slavery. What a tremendous God-honoring film. Hansen, true story, South African made. A really well-made film. Tornado, also a South African made film. Top class, excellent effort. And Fireproof, one of the best films on marriage that I've ever seen. And now we saw recently Letters to God, which is also outstandingly well-made. Number six, pray for wisdom. Pray for discernment. Learn to think critically and teach children godly discernment. So give yourself a discerning heart to distinguish between right and wrong. And Movie Guide helps us do that. Number seven, discuss the film and its characters and message in the light of the Bible. What would you do differently? And so on. If you were the key protagonist, then just discuss it in light of the scriptures. Number eight, speak up for moral, God-honoring entertainment. And speak out against blasphemous, degrading, exploitative productions. Write to or phone the producers of TV programs and scriptwriters, directors, producers of films, and Movie Guide often publishes their contact details at the end of their reviews, so that's good. And always be sure to praise the good as well as to criticize the bad. Let's not just complain when there's something wrong. There's a lot of good things to be grateful for too, such as New Metro's new faith film festivals where they've been putting on screen films like Letters to God, which is very praiseworthy. So get informed, be discerning. Every time you purchase a cinema ticket or rent or buy a video, you're casting a vote. Just be sure that you're only investing in family-friendly and God-honoring movies. Well, we've got quite a lot of resources on the tables out there. There's a lot of literature for free to help yourself to. And you'll see also film reviews in quite a few of our Christian Action magazines. We've got movie reviews, and Christian Action magazines websites have got a lot more. To know the history, we've got quite a few books and DVDs to help understand what's the story behind many of the films, and if you can understand the worldviews behind, and these are some great resources. I wonder if anyone's got any questions at all. Any questions, comments, and movies? Yes? Apocalypto. Absolutely outstanding and well worth seeing. In fact, I would say Apocalypto should be compulsory viewing for every sociology student at university. Because it shows, and it's a hard film to see, but it shows the reality of what pagan cultures were like before the gospel got there. And for that reason, Mel Gibson is recommended. I personally snip out the first 20 minutes of the film, which I think is just unnecessary. But the rest of it, I think, is... You know, I don't know why I had to just put in some of that silly humour at the beginning, but once it gets on with it, the film is outstanding. And I must say, when you suddenly see at the end the ships coming with the Catholics, you realise, you know, even that wasn't improvement to what these poor guys had before. It puts the conquistadors into perspective. Exactly. It puts the conquistadors, the Spanish conquistadors, into perspective. So far, people have been criticising the conquistadors for ruining the beautiful, advanced Mayan culture. Well, I think they could have only done improvement. It's essential that we do get history like that. Mel Gibson's done with a passion, and Apocalypto, he's given us two magnificent films, both of which strike at the heart of humanism. And Apocalypto, while it's a rough film to see, it just kicks out the legs from underneath all these anti-Christian pagans who've been saying for so many years, all these wonderful civilizations that existed before the gospel. Well, it's about time this was exposed. Any other comments? I could have said something about Zulu. Now, there's two films. There's Zulu Dawn, which is a good film, well made, on a battle of Eastern Ireland, which is a Zulu victory. And the other's called Zulu. It was the first film which Michael Caine had acted in. And in fact, Zulu Dawn is well worth seeing. It's accurate. Burt Lancaster, Peter O'Toole, really, really well made. And courageous. But the film Zulu, on the British victory at Rooksdrift, is pathetic. That film is a disgrace. It is so ahistoric, and it's again got anti-Christian nonsense that it injects. It takes all the Christian testimony of the key defenders of Rooksdrift out. It puts a drunken missionary in the middle of it who was never there, and he wasn't a drunk anyway, and puts a lot of rubbish in. And there's such long stretches of border. I don't know how Hollywood could ever produce such a boring film, but such an exciting event as the Battle of Rooksdrift. But anyway, so Zulu, I would boycott that film, and Zulu Dawn I would support. But anyway, those are just some of the things that we need to know about a history and background. This Understanding History 12-disc series goes back to AD 30, so it takes church history. It does a sweep through the last 2,000 years.
It doesn't cover the Old Testament.
It does not, not yet. We're going to get there.
It's
church history, but it covers a lot of the political, military events because that all affected it. But Understanding History is understand the last 2,000 years. We've got to go further back, I know, but... that's just as far as we've got so far. We've got Heroes of the Faith, an MP3, where we put 30 different character studies, because I think the best way to know history is to know the people, the characters, to get to know the events through the individuals. And some of the most important ones, like the Reformation, we put 27 character studies together on that. In January, we run a Biblical Worldview Summit in Cape Town, where we go in a lot more depth. If you can't get there, the MP3, of course, these are just the lectures. This does not deal with the personal discussion times, the PT, the hikes, the boating, the debating games and all the rest of it, but if a person wants just the lectures, we do have those available. And there's a lot of other materials too, but there is the course, which is very hands-on in a beautiful campsite in Cape Town. Any other comments, questions? No, I mean, when I'm promoting the Passion of Christ, I'm talking about 92% or so is really, I think, biblical. They do seem to have a bit of the superstitious funny things like the cloth that covered Jesus' face. And you think, okay, there's a bit of Catholic superstition here. But if I compare the Passion with Jesus of Nazareth, or even the Jesus call, the Passion of the Christ is more factual and biblical in terms of what the sufferings of Christ were, then I think these other films, which you'd normally not have much problem with, the fact that a Roman Catholic was involved in the making of it makes one uneasy, and there was a little bit of Catholic superstition put in, but you know, I think we put up with more strange things with the other films than we have, unless we were very critical. I went there with a very critical mind, and I've read a lot of criticism on it, but I still think we can use the Passion. Is overwhelmingly, I think it points people back to the Bible.
Is it the biblical fact that Jesus fell three times on that journey to the golden tongue? Is that a well-known Christian fact? Because that is portrayed like that in the movie, and a Catholic friend of mine was sitting right next to me, he said to me, yeah, because in that tradition, they know it perfectly that it happened like that. And it's exactly portrayed like that in the movie, but it was news to me.
In the Passion of the Christ, they stick to the Stations of the Cross, which is very much part of Catholic catechism. I went to a Catholic school when I was young, so I know about all of that. We were pushed, we saw it in the windows, the stained glass windows, and the pictures in the classroom. So, yes, it definitely had all that. But the fact still is, Jesus did suffer in the way that has been depicted. And I think for the first time, a film focused on the crucifixion of Christ in a way that needed to be. I think that the other films, the Protestant films, have glossed over the crucifixion and have not given done justice. So, in a sense, shame on us that it took a Catholic to produce it. And it's not surprising he injected a bit of his Catholic superstitions with it. The resurrection was far too short.
No, I mean, sorry, not the resurrection, he's going up to heaven.
The ascension wasn't there, no. It was just the 3 days depicted here, but...
Because my understanding, I think it's the ascension that really motivated the disciples who ran away and escaped being murdered with him and said, we don't know him, to all eventually lose their lives.
Well, the resurrection is the most important, but the ascension is vital for our Christian understanding, because the ascension deals with authority, that Christ is ascended above all authority, that he's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. The Great Commission is linked with the ascension of Christ. So I find it sad that the average church today is not having Ascension Day services and is not focusing on it. We should regard Ascension as one of the four most important Christian holidays in any year. It's Jesus is not just a baby in a manger. He's not just a dead Savior on a cross. He is risen from dead, but he's ascended to heaven, and he's coming again to judge the living and dead, and he's above all authority and power. So the ascension is an essential fourth leg of the Christian doctrines. In a calendar, we need incarnation, crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension. It is important, so... It's a pity it didn't put some more attention on the victory at the very end. It was powerfully done, but it was very short. Yes?
Thank you for my opening presentation. One of the things that I've come to believe is that, especially when you look at young people in South Africa, the influence comes from mainly music and movies. And I wanted to know if there's anything that you are doing, because I believe that we must try and not only produce movies locally, but we must also look at our history, you know, and as you say, accurately portrayed, especially in Christian history. Now, I just want to know whether there are any projects that you're involved in, you know, in documenting the history in South Africa, and also what is it that we, maybe as individuals or community, can do to begin to document, you know, our history around the nation, especially that which is Christian.
Thank you for the question. That's very important. In our mission, we work on Christian history books, and I'm working on a Christian history of Africa. I'm working on a Greatest Century series. I did the Greatest Century of Missions, Greatest Century of Reformation. My next is the Greatest Century of Persecution, the 20th century. And then I'll do the Greatest Century of Revival, which would be the 18th century, and the Greatest Century of the Puritans, which will be the 17th century. So I'm working my way through the last 5 centuries, finding a main theme, and then putting lots of stories and lots of pictures as a taster to wet people's appetite. So providing some history books, Slavery, Terrors of Islam is another one of our history books. Faith in the Defiance of Man, that people can know what Islam has been doing there. So we've produced a number of history books, a lot of history CDs and PowerPoints, and we've tried to import as many DVDs as possible that are useful. What if Jesus had been born, which we'll be showing tomorrow night, is an outstanding, probably the best first stop, 1 hour overview of Christianity's contribution and history. Dr. James Kennedy's Coleridge Ministry put together absolutely superb. The book and this DVD is some of the most important material we could use. So that's part of it. I'm involved in a number of other different projects. Quite aside from our Reformation site, producing many lectures and PowerPoints and articles, our Reformation website, I should point out, we've got quite a lot on our website on different history events. This is the 150th anniversary of the 1860 revival, so we're focusing on that a lot. Revivals, Bible character studies, Christian Action website. The Reformation SA website's got a lot of history materials, reformationsa.org, and so you'll see a lot there. There's some film projects that I'm in touch with producers on, and I'm helping them with some of the script. There's a film on David Livingstone that I've been working for ages, sending it back to the scriptwriter saying, you've got to be kidding, this didn't happen, this isn't true, this is ridiculous, what on earth are you putting this rubbish in here for? And I thought, oh, it seems like this. The reality of David Livingstone is so exciting. You don't need to fictionalize anything. And whenever they start going to make a form of the life of Jesus, when they stick to the scriptures, it's powerful. When they start innovating and going into imagination, it's pathetic. So this is my ongoing battle with some of our friends in Hollywood. They keep going off the truth and thinking that somehow their imagination is better than the truth of history, which it isn't. It doesn't have the same impact. And often it just doesn't ring true. So, David Livingstone project has been dragged out for a long time, but I'm bashing heads against the people who keep wanting to inject garbage into the story. And David Livingstone is one of the best friends Africa ever had. We need the story to be told. It's exciting. I'd like to see a film made in Henry Morgan Stanley, the first man to cross the Congo, go from all the way across Tanzania down the Congo River, and his In Darkest Africa, Through the Dark Continent, some of the most spectacular books on what Africa was like before the gospel took hold there. So Henry Stanley's works, these are some things. We're getting the old books, we're trying to interest filmmakers with making it. I've met with Rickard van den Berg, and he's come to our mission and had long interviews. We're trying to give him some projects, African history projects that he might take on. And of course, he's got to also get funding for these projects. So we should support the people who are making films. Praise God for our local filmmakers and for Christian filmmakers overseas. We need more. Dr. Ted Baer produced a book called So You Want to Be in the Movies. And in it, he gives key information. He's been in movies all his life, and his father was in the movies before him and so on, successfully so. And anyone who wants to be a scriptwriter, he says the biggest need right now is for Christian scriptwriters. And a Christian, because of course writing a book isn't the same as writing a script. Scriptwriting is a specific, you've got to think vision, you've got to think music, you've got to think a whole range of different things, and it's got to be short. It can't be as long as the average book. You've got to telescope things and make it run smoothly. And a film needs jeopardy, and it needs tension, and it needs pacing. You can't just have some documentary catalogue. It's got to be a a flowing, racy, fast-moving plot with jeopardy, or it's not going to work. I mean, films are like that. And this is what makes some films like Fire Proof work, but they managed to get that. Or Apocalypto is classic and how they got the jeopardy, and they just kept that race all along, and they didn't let you out until the end. Now, that's an extraordinarily effective film, how they introduce the jeopardy early on and keep the race, and don't let you off the hook.
That's it.
I mean that's a classic. And so, for example, the David Livingstone film, because Livingstone's life's a long thing, to have one film in his life, how do you do this? So, you've got to do something like that. Their main thought was, you take the plot from the point of Henry Morton Stanley, who's tracking Livingstone, and he's reading through his diaries, and so you have flashbacks of some of these exciting things as well, as he's on the trail of Livingstone, so that you've got to keep the pace, instead of having it starting when he's born, and you start on the trail, and you show it through the eyes of a skeptic, like Stanley, who's a secular, unbelieving man, and he's a journalist, and he's after story, and he's, so I think that's the right plot, but they had too many red herrings, so you had to keep dragging them back to the facts. A scriptwriter, we need Christian scriptwriters. And the scriptwriter's key, but then you need Christian directors and producers. Because you can have a good script and then the director or producer can wreck it. In fact, the scriptwriters and producers and directors are more important than the actors, believe it or not, when you get down to it, into determining the angle of the film. So, yes, instead of just cursing the bad, we need to light a candle. It's better to light a candle and curse the darkness. So, yes, I trust that all of us can do something. Maybe some people here, we be called to produce some Christian scripts into movies in one way or the other. We do have some alternatives. Praise God for Joy Magazine, praise God for Yoke, praise God for Christian community radio stations, for alternatives for those who are producing Christian curriculums. I think a lot more. This is all early days. Any other comments? Yes?
Why do you think it was made a lot?
2012. I didn't want to see it, but I did see it in the end because I was on a long flight, 14-hour flight, and I was on there and thought, well, at least I don't have to pay the money or rent the movie and make a vote for this film because I knew it was anti-Christian. It's amazing how they dare to hijack Christian concept for their pagan worldview. The whole film is basically moving towards a Noah's Ark, or a few Noah's Arks actually, and yet there's no acknowledgement of God. They hate God. The man who did the film said he had a lot of joy in ruining Christian symbols. For example, having the Christians at the Vatican praying for protection for this, and then having the Vatican roll over and crush them all while they're praying for protection. He liked showing the shattering and collapse of the Jesus statue at Rio de Janeiro. And so in an interview, he was asked, so why don't you show the cargo being destroyed in Mecca? He says, you're crazy. I don't want some suicide bomber going after me. So it shows what a coward he is. He doesn't like religion, but he only goes after Christian things. So in the movie, if you've noticed how he, first of all, I've got the Mayan calendar. I hear Mayan friends again, which Apocalypto exposed, a bunch of savages ripping, beating hearts out of living people on the tops of these pyramids to make the sunrise tomorrow. Really, for goodness sakes. And they produced a calendar that shows the world's going to end in 2012, and I'm meant to take it seriously. So what? They didn't have the wheel. And I've got to listen to what they've got to say about the future. So this is bizarre. Who cares about the Mayan calendar? The timing of the film was that it came out and he said his goal was to provide support for the Copenhagen Global Warming Conference, to panic people to support it. It's just a pity that the coldest winter in history happened to hit and they couldn't even fly out of any of those places because of all the snow falling during this global warming. Shame. So 2012, it's an extremely expensive anti-Christian propaganda pick to try and stampede support for giving more power to the globalists for the one world, new world order. It's an interesting piece of digital technology and special effects, but yeah, you can't take anything seriously at all. No.
No, there's a purpose for why they need to.
And what did you pick up from it? Scam is to pay people into supporting political agendas to transfer power and money and control to a bunch of globalist New World Order, One World Crown, who are all anti-Christian anyway. So there's nothing that's attractive about it. I would look at this 2012 and say, oh, what a lot of propaganda. And how dare they take the Noah redemption picture from the Bible and hijack it for the humanists. Can't they even come up with their own original solution to the problem? Straight back to, without any reference to the Bible or Noah or God. It's just, it's so dishonest. So, yeah, that's what we think of 2012.